Right now it is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us every Friday at this time, and we welcome him in. I don't know if it's raining where David is or not. Good morning, David.
Good morning. I'm glad to be with you. And it's not raining here in New York, at least not yet.
It will be.
Media capital of the world, so far escaping the drenching we were promised.
All right. Well, I don't know. I think, unfortunately, David, the media cap of the world has become Donald Trump.
Well, you know, that's the downside of being a New Yorker these days. Yes, our city is so clearly identified with a particular politician and a particular subject of the current election rounds. Total focus. I mean, the one thing that you could always say about midterms when the election season for them comes around is that the president is not on the ballot. That's absolutely right. But this time, he may not be in the ballot, but he's certainly the focus of the midterms, as far as the media concerns, as far as the media is concerned, and more importantly, I think, as far as the president himself is concerned. It's a remarkable and distinctive, I don't believe this has happened before, when a president has actually made himself or declared himself to be the subject of a referendum with the midterms. This is a referendum on me, he said. And, that's something of a hostage to fortune to declare.
You know, what's interesting about it, I'm 66, so I've voted since I've been 18, so very close to voting for 50 years. Now, I've never seen a midterm like this, but an ingenious thing that Donald Trump has done is, as he sees that he is probably, I'll say, 80 to 90% likely to lose the House and lose the House by about 15 or 20 votes, he has focused his campaign on Donald Trump in 2018 on Senate races so he can secure the Senate, so he can avoid any form of impeachment. Really, if you look at what he's doing, that's exactly what he's doing. He gave up on the House, and he is trying to secure the Senate so he's got some form of support.
Yeah, it's an interesting campaign tactic. To concentrate on the Senate. Sure, it's a kind of a safety net for him for when things doubtlessly, if the Democrats do win and win big, or at least substantially in the House, and, you know, will subject him to all sorts of inquiries and possibly even an impeachment drive. I mean, you can't achieve an achievement if you don't have the Senate in favor of convicting the president when impeached. But the other thing is that he's not only concentrating on the Senate, but he's actively, in some ways, courting the idea of a hostile House in the last 2 years of his presidential term. It seems to appeal to his sense of always wanting to be fighting, you know, in a fight, actually dukes up. And it suits his temperament. It suits this particular tactical decision that seems to have been made. And it suits just the general tenor of the times. And the tenor of the times is something that I've been thinking a lot about as we get towards actual voting day on Tuesday, November 6th, or is it 5th? It's 5th, isn't it? November 5th. It's a big day. And, you know, for another time around, with these very high temperature campaigning tactics and issues that have come to the fore, especially about immigration, citizenship, and the like, with their racist and absolutely racist, indeed. There's certainly xenophobic undertones. Undertones? Not even undertones. Just straight out there, clear tones. Yeah. I'm wondering if this is worse than I've ever heard it. I lived through an awful lot of elections. I've been enabled to, I've been allowed, I've been privileged enough to vote for the last 12 years in this country. I'm a citizen now, and I delight in my capacity to exercise my citizen's right to vote. But I don't think, I think to myself, I've never felt the tenor of the times to be so bad. But then, you know, when I look back, actually, I'm exaggerating. Memory can do that to me. I don't, you know, I think every time as you get towards that particular date, whatever it is, which day in November it is, each 4 years as they pass by, you'll recall that, God, you know, things got pretty nasty then too in the past.
You know, it is, by the way, it is Tuesday, the number is 6, it is the 6th, but what you say
is... Oh, thanks. I'm getting my dates mixed up with a British event that takes place on the 5th, when we commemorate the burning, or the attempted burning...
Right, Parliament.
Parliament.
This is a bonfire day.
I see that on the calendar, right. And that looms large,
the
too.
The gunpowder plot.
I can't imagine why it does.
But your comment about it not being worse, I thought that, you know what makes it, when Richard Nixon was president, it was bad. There was a lot with the Vietnam War, with Watergate. So midterms were bad. But there wasn't social media back then. That's the whole big difference.
That's the horror.
But the whole amazing thing about this is Donald Trump is campaigning not only for the midterms for himself, but he's been the first person elected president who really effectively started campaigning for his reelection, really almost a month after he was elected. So to him, this is just a stepping stone, if he secures the Senate, which he probably will, to him trying to keep the nomination, become stronger for 2020.
I have to say, and this is just really frustrating, has been most helpful in his endeavor.
For sure,
that's true. You know, if you really do believe that the elections are about who's on the ballot, then the media would probably, you know, be sensible in just downplaying the president's, or at least not giving it the extraordinary focus that they seem to have wanted to do. And as you say, from very early too. I mean, the truth is, Marshall, as you know, every president has wanted to campaign for a second term, almost the moment he gets in. As soon as he gets over his terror at actually occupying that seat, which I think you would only have to be only human to have, people are already looking forward. The thing about Trump that's somewhat different is that he's actually gone on campaigning rallies as early as he has. You know, it doesn't mean that they have to be focused on and reported so profusely as they have been. I'm getting behind the swell of opinion now myself that we don't have to report on this president as much as we do.
So, and that was one of my questions when I was listening to the two of you. What is everyone, you know, you're going to have to start covering 2020 on Wednesday.
But they've already, I'll give media credit, a little bit of credit here, the mainstream media, is that they've already cut back on covering these daily press briefings, and they have cut back where they're not covering the rallies in full. Let me finish here. They're not covering the rallies in full like they used to. They used to cover it from start
to
finish.
I totally agree.
And what the Democrats and other people in politics who have other ideas need to do is step up to the plate. In today's social media, and David, you know this better than anybody, in today, you've got to be something. Look at what's his name in Texas, Beto, what's his last name?
With the teeth? Beto O'Rourke?
Beto O'Rourke. Now, there's a guy, if he loses, the Democrats should put him out on the road right away, because you know what? He knows how to communicate with young people.
But I've got a question.
But that's the problem. The media is caught in this quandary where, you know, then not only do they have to cover the news, they have to cover social media. They think they have to be part of social media.
Yeah, that's wrong.
That's the problem with mainstream media right now.
And this is just simply my opinion, but that is wrong. Whoever let them do that, you know, it reminds me. Look,
they should lead.
Are sheep.
They should lead social media, not run
from it.
Social media should be following the mainstream networks.
Except that going back to cable, you're absolutely right, but going back to cable, you know, that the print news started running on the visuals, like, because a car crash is much more interesting than a tome full of conflicting positions.
I think you get to the heart of what journalism is about, I'm afraid, and recognize that I'm not going to apply these labels to particular kinds of media, but I mean the constant division whenever any journalistic outfit makes a decision about priorities, you have a combination of what's the meat and what's the sizzle. It's so attractive, it's so easy, it's so tempting, it's so lazy in some ways to go for the sizzle because it's obvious. And if you go for the sizzle, here I am, I'm going to say what I mean by sizzle in this particular context. If you're led by your desire to score big in social media and get all those eyeballs and those retweets and repostings, then you're going to go for the sizzle every time, and that's a distinct. It will absolutely ensure that your journalism is the poorer for it.
You know, it's funny because you do apply that to everybody in broadcasting. You sell the sizzle, and what news media used to do is they used to supply why the sizzle is there. God, they used to.
We just assume that it's going to be sizzling, and we don't.
There you go.
All the time, seems as if we don't even know what it is that's sizzling.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And I saw something this morning. It was too early to send to. I wasn't going to be able to get it to you, but it was. The way this was framed in The Guardian, this is from The Guardian, from a news briefing from The Guardian. Quote, Asian markets were cheered by a tweet from Donald Trump suggesting trade talks with China were moving along nicely. Okay? So market was cheered by a tweet from Donald Trump. Now, here's how the SCMP, the South China Morning Post, covered it. Donald Trump and Xi Jinping have a good conversation about trade war ahead of G20 meeting. Both leaders have confirmed the phone call, with Trump calling it a good call, and Xi saying differences must be resolved. They are expected to meet on November 30th.
Yeah.
Although a resolution
The fact that the phone call took place at all is worth remarking on, and some major media outlets give it its appropriate weight, if you like. And the South China Morning Post is a pretty steady reporter of this whole scene, and I think we can take that as pretty much a
suggestion
simple,
that
piece of reporting.
It's a good piece of reporting, and it suggests that the undercard has, like, they've duped it out, and we're moving on to the next step. Just as the last Sunday, I'm sure you noticed above the fold the of the paper of record, the New York Times. You saw those images of the babies in Yemen, and buried in this week's. Twice was the Secretary of State calling for withdrawal.
A ceasefire.
Ceasefire. Yeah. And, let's stop this. And then there was also something in Qatar. And what I default to constantly is, I am pretty sure that most people don't have the time or the inclination to seek out the South China Morning Post. And so they're going to read, a tweet from Donald Trump. Yeah. So, well, we don't believe anything he says. And it's, nobody is help. It doesn't appear that the very people who should be helping are helping. That's all.
Well, the sizzle does tend to get more attention. It's almost by definition
what
the nature of sizzle is. Yeah. Always has. Yeah.
So
by the way, it's a sad note, but the little girl who was featured so prominently in that very, very striking report by the New York Times on the effects of the scorched earth war conducted in Yemen, which is starvation for millions, as well as constant danger of death and a very, very high casualty toll already, with that awful, I mean, heart-rending picture of the young girl who's just basically skin and bones, photographed by the remarkable Tyler Hicks, one of the New York Times' most astonishing photographers. She actually died yesterday. So, you know, that small individual case of the human toll of that appalling war is now just another statistic. But I hope that on the way, as you suggest, perhaps, that journalism has made its contribution to at least getting some talks going to end this this horrible, horrible war.
Which has been going on, and this is part of
six years or more now. Yes.
My objection to, again, the imbalanced presentation, I never know how to say this word. Is it hagiography?
Hagiography? Yeah, well, it's funny. It ought to be a hagiography, but by custom and practice, it's ended up being hagiography because I think we like the word hag.
I like
even though it's got no connection with witches or anything like
none,
that.
None, but it's the right time of year. So, all right, so the hagiography. You know, it totally, this was going on, but it completely interfered with the hagiography or hagiographic, if I can even say that, presentation of the Crown Prince, who is also in difficulty now. But the choices were made because that war has been going on longer than, that war has been going on for a while, and it was totally ramped up. But it just, in my view, sadly, the coverage was dimmed by the PR campaign. And
sure.
That's, you know, again, one has to make choices and one has to pay bills. And that's, I'm going to jump from that to how much money has been spent on these bloody midterms. Because it's just ridiculous. And I know people, present company included, who are scratching away trying to have an independent voice. I mean, scratching.
And, to get the money, you mean? Sure.
Yeah.
And the dark money, the unaccounted for money, the anonymous money that has been poured into these midterms is again, unprecedented.
And
we can't even put an authentic figure on it because, of course, so much of it is dark and unknown.
Therefore, and so, you know, why does Beto O'Rourke have, what is it, $70 million or whatever, that money that's left over at the end that's sent by people from all over, you know, it's almost like, excuse me, sorry about this, it's almost like putting a puppy on Facebook and saying, you know, somebody should buy this because we're going to euthanize him. You know,
there are tactics for raising money, and some of them are worse than others. And indeed, in this case, we have a superfluity of funding. We passed the first $1 billion election in 2012, I guess it was, and it's going to go on mushrooming, rocketing, or whatever the right term of speech should be for it. But and of course we know that it's distinctive. I'm not sure if it's unique in the world, but it's certainly the emphasis on the volume of funding that goes into American elections is remarkable. I mean, there's no two ways about it. There's the atmosphere that's created by this extraordinary superfluity of money sloshing around without equal. At least the temperature that's created by it is, along with everything else, of course, the rhetoric of American elections is not worse than anywhere else, but there's certainly, as you say, an amplification of it by social media that makes it so utterly repellent if you're a balanced and reasonable person as you get towards that early Tuesday in November that comes around every 4 years.
And then, because of the way that this has been, I mean, people have dined out on the divide that was created by not covering both sides, yay. So what do you do on Wednesday?
Exactly.
Because you're going to find, I mean, there's a pretty good chance that people are, you know, have baked in their positions. So they're going to be those positions on Wednesday that are no different than they were on Monday. So you're going to have to cover, you're going to have to do something. I can't remember. What was the Tim Russert, Ohio? Do you remember what year that was?
I remember him using the quote, but I now don't remember what its significance was.
The
early campaign, he, of course, is referring to.
It was the election. It was his whiteboard, and it was because what happened is, at the time there wasn't the social media as much, but there was. There were political shows where people went on. And the point is that as soon as the election occurred, what it was called, it must have been the Bush election. It must have been. But it's entirely possible that I'm conflating it. The point is that there was nothing to talk about for 2 years. It was just, you know, you could just see the bookers pulling out their hair because that was it. It was done, and now... You know, the run-up had happened, the game was played, now you have to wait for spring training again.
Right, and the primaries.
Right.
Yeah.
And so back when there was still a little bit of aeration in the whole thing, instead of this dense tort of every day is a step on the way to the next election, there was time to, shall we say, catch breath.
Well, a big way to get rid of what's happening with all this outside money. I mean, there always used to be outside money coming into elections, but it was a small percent, 15-20% at tops on local elections. When I say local, I mean congressional. I'm not talking about Senate races. I'm talking about Congress and on down. Even in state races, there's people who run for a representative in Connecticut have friends in New York to donate, which has, they have no reason to donate other than their friends. But Citizens United changed the whole picture completely. It opened up dark money to the tunes of hundreds, a billion dollars. And that money now floods wherever it's needed. And that dark money now comes from conservatives, progressives, liberals, independents. Anybody who's got money has a chance to flood the market. And they take advantage of it. And they don't have to be identified. Corporations are treated like people. That has really opened the floodgates for the incredible amount of money that is going into some of these campaigns.
Sure.
Yeah, well, how do we get some of that?
Well, it's not a question of how you get some.
I have to funnel that money into worthy media efforts like independent, local, public radio.
Well, it's what you do is you end Citizens United, you fight, you end it, and you find other ways for people. Listen, people are going to spend money in elections. I could care less if Sheldon Adelson spends $2 billion or Tom Steyer spends $1 million. But as long as I know they're the ones doing it and where it's coming from, I say, it's their money. They have a right to do it. But it's when you don't know where the money comes from.
And
that's what we have to end. And that's what Citizens United doesn't do. Citizens United went way too far.
As well as anybody else, that just snapping your fingers and saying get rid of Citizens United isn't going to do it. It's going to require an awful lot of work that clock back.
Awful lot of work from a bunch of people who maybe aren't so up for that work.
And what's great about it is if a corporation wants to donate $100 million to a candidate and they do it and the public sees it, you see what the public has been able to do with corporations. Is with social media. Corporations will become...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And
that comes right down to the most extraordinary example this week, Land O'Lakes, the butter company in Minnesota, is is now not going to support Steve King, a statewide candidate, representative. Well, not statewide, but a congressional district, certainly, simply because of his very clear connections with white supremacists. And that's the power of knowledge. And knowledge in this case promulgated largely by social media, to give it its credit in this particular instance. We do know where that money is coming from and where it might have gone. It would in a normal run of events gone to the Republican candidate, and in this case it has not, because old style Republicans are so horrified by the white supremacist tone to this campaign, just as much as anybody else is, or perhaps not just as much, but are horrified, and so much so that it's a strategic and, bottom line based argument for a company like Land O'Lakes. We don't want to be associated with this.
I can just say that I actively got involved in following politics and policy when I was a sophomore in high school, and in my early days out of high school, I never thought that at the age of 66, I would be so depressed at the state of politics and the state of politics, not only in this country, but in what apparently is across the world. It really, I never thought we would be in this position again.
Yeah, but again, the coverage is so repulsive that
I just never thought I'd see the rise of anti-Semitism, and like it has. And I'm not only talking against Jews, against blacks, and not only in this country. I'm talking about this nationalistic.
Yay for social media.
Because
you create a platform where people can sit and talk about their views privately with like-minded people. What do you think is going to happen?
I would think that people would. I would think that our countries would not become so nationalist and understand that it's a world that we have to live in. And that's what's sad.
Yes, if you look at our country, look at Italy, Hungary, Poland, and the others where this whole phenomenon is working out. Sure, social media has played its part. And the important thing to say is that the big, and here we are dealing with big corporations again, who are also in many ways black boxes into themselves, and we don't know exactly how they're making the decisions and about what's allowable and what's not allowable on their platforms. They've all been, at varying degrees, they've all been overtaken by the sheer capacity that their platforms have for vitriol, and they're having to live with it now.
That will be fun. Thank you very much. David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.
Thank you.